Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of The Daily Friend Show. I'm back, and today I'm joined by Mr. Michael Morris. Let's get into the news of this week. So we got a piece of news today, which was, I must say, quite amusing. And that is that former chief whip of the MK party in Parliament, and also holding many other positions in various political organizations, Pauline Makabula has resigned as an MK party MP. She said that in her resignation letter, quote, "After careful consideration, I've decided that in the best interests of the MK party caucus at this time, I believe that I can better serve the country and its citizens by utilizing my skills, qualifications, and experience in a different capacity." Now, Pauline Makabula has been on quite a journey. She was, I think, pretty much unknown when she was elected to the Joburg City Council as a candidate for COPE. She was then through the coalition agreement with the DA and Action SA and all the other parties involved in that one, elevated to become Speaker of the City of Johannesburg. She then switched her support to supporting the ANC-EFF coalition in Johannesburg, but stayed on the Speaker. She eventually was removed and went on to start her own political party, the South African Rainbow Coalition or something like that. I can't remember its exact name, which I remember seeing posters for, actually, a surprising number of them. I don't know where she got the funding for it. But anyway, that didn't really go anywhere. And shortly after the election and her party failed to get any seats, she joined the MK party. In MK, she was very quickly promoted through the ranks, rising from a sort of entry MP who had just joined the party all the way to becoming the party's chief whip, replacing Manzoela Manyi as the chief whip. She somewhat amusingly, when the appropriations bill was put to a vote in the National Assembly, she indicated that MK would support the bill when in fact they meant to not support it, which was quite an embarrassing mistake. In November of last year, she was chucked out as the party's parliamentary leader for a brief period of time when John Klopp fired her and replaced her with Des van Rooyen. Although, as is the curse of Des van Rooyen, he didn't stay in that position very long, the infamous weekend special, as he is known, and she was reinstated shortly thereafter by Jacob Zuma, who was apparently out of the country when the decision was made. However, in January, she was removed as chief whip anyway by Zuma, with Mbabato Mokoena Zondi being moved from the National Council provinces to be the new MK party chief whip. And now, of course, she's resigned as the MK party chief whip. As an MP. Michael, you know, a whole long story there. And it's kind of been, like, firstly, as a sort of political career, it's sort of been an interesting thing to watch, right? This sort of rise from nowhere to prominence, burning out with incredible speed. And now, I mean, who knows, maybe she'll still stick around in politics, but I doubt that she's going to be much of a factor anymore. What do you make of this? And secondly, once again, I think this speaks to the overall point that we've made many times about the MK party. This is not an organization with any sort of stability or capacity, and that's going to make it very hard for it to continue to exist even for the next few years. What's your take on this?
I was quite intrigued by her her saying, and it's, you know, quite a sensible and cogent comment. She says, "I continue to echo the call for all African leaders in politics to rise above identity politics." I'm generously assume that what she means by African leaders is this includes John Steenhuisen, for instance, to rise above identity politics. I assume she can only mean in a non-racial sense, party affiliations, personality driven agendas.
I would not make that assumption.
No, it clearly isn't. She isn't there. But so there's already this clash of things. She's, you know, saying African leaders need to rise above this politics of identity politics, party affiliations, personality-driven agendas. I mean, this is really what the MK really largely is, ethnic divisions. And yet she's been playing in the space of organizations and parties who are only really stimulating those old grievances, not showing any particular intelligence or energy in developing ideas from about, you know, what we do now. If we face the front, what is the next thing to be done? What is going to actually serve the people of South Africa? And the people expressly who've been subjected to and are victims of, in a sense, in so many different ways, not just a sense, many senses, of precisely identity politics, personality-driven agendas, ethnic divisions. I mean, we see these parties exploiting these. The apartheid itself was obviously an expression of that. But it takes, you know, clear, simple choices. And you can't play in this space and make these sorts of claims. So it is all very, very perplexing and puzzling. As you say, she might well pop up somewhere else. But this is not, you know, this certainly doesn't create the impression of somebody who is really serious about changing South Africa for the better, but is simply looking for a home where she's more or less tolerated and if not necessarily welcomed. Not a particularly encouraging story from her point of view, I don't think.
It also says something interesting about MK that she was, I think, pushed up through the ranks so quickly. The question sort of is why. And, you know, once again, I'm going to assume, and I don't know this for sure, obviously, but I'm going to assume it's because she had a good relationship with Jacob Zuma. And this meant that she went from, you know, not even campaigning for the party to being one of its leaders in this incredibly short space of time. So much so that he humiliated some of his longtime sort of co-conspirators, his allies, who had stuck by him all these years by reversing the decision to remove her as party leader. So that, I think, really does speak to the problem that the MK party has, beyond some of the institutional stuff, right, that they obviously don't have much of a structure. It's that it's clear that Jacob Zuma, I think, doesn't quite have the sort of cunning and self-restraint that he once would show. Sometimes, I mean, you know, Zuma's a complicated man, but he often had this cunning, this political intelligence that allowed him to become this force in South African politics. And her entire trajectory through the MK party, to me, suggests that he's kind of losing his edge on that front. Do you agree with me?
Yeah. Yes, I think so. You know, a great chess player by all accounts, and chess players are usually astute, and they can foresee strategic options in a way that you know, most of us perhaps don't necessarily or couldn't be bothered to sometimes. But I think he did set much store by having a very clear idea of the strategic landscape and what his options were, and choosing them quite astutely, as you say. He's getting on a bit. I know myself, heading into the sort of second half of the 60s, it's just inevitable. You begin to forget things, and you're slightly less sharp than you thought you might have been. This is just one of those things. Whether he's been able to confront himself and think, well, perhaps I am just too old to be, you know, trying to run a new party, trying to make it distinctive, and try to, you know, address all these things that she speaks of, creating an equitable society. I mean, that seems, of course, quite an ironic thing: fighting poverty and corruption, addressing youth unemployment, working towards a unified, democratic South Africa. I could think of a couple of other parties, at least one in particular, that she would probably find expresses these things far better, and actually has the policies to achieve them to boot. It's not likely that she's going to be, based on her performance so far, that she's going to be drifting towards a more sensible position.
And, you know, for me, this is another, fitting into the larger picture of where South African politics is at the moment. I think that the South African sort of ANC universe, the sort of far left of South African politics, has a major problem, right? It doesn't have a champion who seems to have steam at the moment. And this was not true until, I think, relatively recently. So the South African far left has, since at least 94, kind of been in the driver's seat, right? In not all the time, like during the Mbeki years, they took a backseat sometimes to pragmatic decisions by the ANC. the EFF was a big thing, of course, that I think gave a lot of energy to that side of South Africa's politics. But if you look now at the three major parties that represent that sort of ideological spectrum, yes, they have this majority in parliament, right? MK, EFF, and ANC. Firstly, while they may have this ideological majority in a sense, they don't vote together in parliament, right? So that unity is broken. But then you look at each of the individual parties, the ANC increasingly lacking credibility, increasingly devolving into infighting, increasingly seeming to lose its liberation shine and become more and more distrusted, sinking in the polls. And that doesn't seem to be going anywhere. The ANC just seems to be going down more. MK Party, we've just discussed, you know, completely chaotic, all bound up in the personality of Jacob Zuma. And then, of course, the EFF, which is the other potential benefactor of the collapse of its two rivals in that space. And yet, as we've seen, Julius Malema doesn't seem to have the energy anymore. He's facing serious legal problems. So my thought that I've expressed before is that that part of our politics is in real trouble, and that their dominance in parliament is actually a bit of a mirage, in the sense that they might, I think they're in trouble come the next election. Do you think I'm being too sort of, you know, counting them out too quickly? What's your thoughts on that, Michael?
No, I certainly don't. I mean, I think there's always the risk that in our society, our history is still so much with us, in a sense, that, you know, there are all sorts of reasons why people might cleave to what they had always imagined would be the solution to their, you know, the source of their redemption. And it might take a while for, you know, levels of trust to develop in other organizations. I think the GNU is helping a great deal to unsettle all those kinds of assumptions. But, you know, just the other day, after the news broke of Clem Santer's death, the sort of great and wonderfully amusing futurist, Clem Santer, I was reminded of, and I looked it up and found a YouTube version of it, of a debate between the two of them, between himself and Julius Malema in 2016, hosted by the Cape Chamber of Business. It was really quite a fascinating thing. It was billed as the rumble in the urban jungle, I think. was what they called. Now, you could see that Clem Santer quite enjoyed this. And, you know, what you see there is a much more assured, sort of comfortably at home Julius Malema talking to business people, basically lecturing them on what, you know, why they're thinking is all completely cockeyed. And, you know, the occasional sort of contradictions from Clem Santer. But essentially, it's really quite interesting to see, just not so long ago, well, I suppose it is 10 years, but these telling 10 years, the EFF looked like, you know, a sort of solid left proposition that was quite confident in the claims it was making and the assertions it was advancing and the proposals it was making. You know, people were sort of paying attention. I just couldn't see that being repeated today, and his coming away with anything like the sort of credible hearing that he was given. I think that is exactly what you've described, in a way, or a reflection of what you've described. That these parties have kind of run out of oomph. The substance just isn't there. I don't think South Africans are there really either. Even the you know, the most deprived ones, they're too busy actually just trying to get the next meal, and that's what they're really focusing on. Whoever's going to give that to them, the next job or the next opportunity, but not more grievance, not more reason to be to be resentful or envious, because these things simply don't help with the next day's supper and the next day's bills. So I think, yeah, I'm inclined to agree with you.
All right, let's move on to our next story. This is talking about the debate on gambling in South Africa. Gambling has, not just in South Africa, but across the world, seemingly exploded, driven, I think, mostly by sports betting, but also in the increasing, how do they call it, the gamification of gambling on your phone. Lots of people nowadays, when they gamble, they don't go to a casino or anything like that. Of course, they do it by an app on their phone. And you know, there's some debate as to how much money is spent on gambling and how big a sort of issue it is. But I think it's something that makes a lot of people uncomfortable. If you've ever come across someone whose life has been affected by a gambling addict or who is a gambling addict, it can be very debilitating, in the same way that, you know, alcohol abuse or narcotics abuse can be. I think there's a general sort of something, there's like a kind of a bit of a social, political fear, which could turn into a panic, that's kind of beginning to bubble through our politics right now. And it's not a completely unjustified one. I do think the stuff is serious stuff, and we need to think about it. Luke Feltham, the editor-in-chief of Business Day, has written an editorial talking about the possibility of getting rid of advertising on gambling. He says that he doesn't think that that gambling should be restricted, because adults have should have the freedom and the choice to be able to make their own decisions, which is something I agree with. He does, however, suggest that by maybe putting in some regulations on gambling advertising, that this will kill the dream, as he says, the sort of sexy image of what the gambling lifestyle can be. And he says that it was the smoking industry where we saw this most effectively, that the coolness of cigarettes was destroyed. I'll just quote a little bit from his piece here. He's making reference to proposals that have been put out by government about possibly regulating gambling advertising. Are we talking only about public spaces, or will this extend not just to print advertising, but also to targeted online promotions? A presentation by the National Gambling Board to the Department in October gave a hint to some of these questions. It mentioned age gating and reducing unintentional viewing, which would necessitate, for example, designated airing hours for television campaigns. Regardless of the eventual answers to these questions, advertising is a good place to start to address a complex issue, and certainly more creative than slapping on some sin taxes and going home. No sensible person should be calling for the outright prohibition of gambling. Either a liberal society demands that adults should and must be left to make their own decisions. As history has routinely taught us, paternalism is really effective. It is almost axiomatic that the target should be lifestyle advertising sells so well. It is where the most pernicious effects of gambling stem from. Teenagers are sucked into high roller fascination long before they're old enough to enter a casino. Struggling parents are persuaded that one good parlay will get them out of debt, and it's all sold on the promise that these futures are just a click away on a smartphone. Michael, I'm in a bit of a complicated place on this issue. I do think there are some serious social costs to this, and I'm, shall we say, open to the idea that there should be some restrictions on the advertising, but it doesn't, it's not something I think the effectiveness of this kind of stuff is overstated. And I also think that you're not really going to make a difference until you have a kind of broader cultural social change. You need to have a society where this stuff, where the attitudes in society change generally. And that's what happened with smoking. Quite frankly, I think smoking still makes you look cool. I grew up well into the anti-smoking era. Now, yes, you know, I understand all the health benefits and things, and I don't smoke myself. For all of those reasons, and most of my peers don't either. But I think what really changed smoking culture was the sort of gradual shift across society. It wasn't the government saying, oh, you can't advertise a cigarette here, you can't do that. It was the fact that parents told that, you know, really pushed their kids not to smoke. It was that schools and peers didn't value it so much and you know, kind of thought of it as silly or not worth it, or expensive and not worth it. It was that society made it harder and harder to smoke. I mean, Michael, you used to be a smoker. You told me about these horrible little tiny smoking designated zones. And, you know, some of that was legally driven, of course, but some of that was also driven just by changing cultural attitudes and the private sector responding to demand. And honestly, I think this is a symptom of South Africa's problem. People are gambling because they don't have hope. And gambling offers hope. And, you know, you can put all the advertising and bigger regulations in place, but we're probably not going to fix this problem until South Africans by and large have hope. So, sorry, long spiel there, but your thoughts on all that?
Yeah, I thought it was a very good spiel. And you know, that fundamental point It seems abstract, but it actually isn't. You know, when people really genuinely believe that they do not need to count on, I think we chatted about this before, on Lady Luck. You know, it's absolutely crazy thing. You won in however many tens of millions, the chances of winning are, you know, are really, really remote. But maybe if you're in that desperate situation, that's going to seem better than waking up again tomorrow morning, as you have done for the past 3 years, and not having the chance of somebody saying, "Well, here's a job for you, and here's and you know, these are the prospects, and welcome." And that is just, you know, with our unemployment rate as it is, almost 40%. I think it still is. It's massive, and that's a huge lifestyle impact, I think, which does push people towards the impossible dream scenario of the only other source of relief is going to be your chances in a gamble. And so I think that is absolutely right. It doesn't seem very comforting, and I'm sure not to people maybe who've got a gambling addict in their midst, and you know that is a very real addiction, and it's a horrible thing. I've known of cases of this, seen the effects. It can be absolutely awful. You know, but the point is, I don't think there's an easy fix. It's not a quick fix to this. It is a reflection of the kind of society we've become, and we get to see a reduction as a reflection of the kind of society we could be. I think probably very much like smoking. And that was, I mean, I was certainly conscious. I gave up because I had a sort of health scare, and quite sudden thing, and a switch just flipped in my brain, and I was able to stop. But I didn't ever think I'd be able to do that, or would decide to do it. I was quite sure I wouldn't ever rationally decide to do it. But nevertheless, I was very conscious of the enormous change in over 15, 20 years in social habits and expectations. From, you know, at one point, I remember in the 90s, at an ordinary dinner party, you'd take out your packet of cigarettes at some point and ask the host or hostess for an ashtray. You know, just expected that an ashtray would appear, and you'd carry on your very serious intellectual chat with a cigarette in your hand. But that all changed. You know, within 10 years, that was completely gone. I remember wandering around Cavendish Square, and you obviously couldn't smoke in the shop. The minute you left the shop and walked out into the concourse, I would light up as other smokers did too. But that eventually became, I mean, if you did that, it became embarrassing, and then taboo. It is all those things that I think do make a huge impact, and not without, I think, some legislative interventions. You know, some of those things arose because the Lord come in. But it's not to rely on the legislation. I often wonder, alone, it's not enough.
How often those legislative things are politicians responding to the cultural change rather than driving the cultural change, which is sort of
I think
sometimes it can be one or the other. You know, I think it's a little bit like, I think also alcohol actually is similar to this. You know, banning alcohol would be a terrible idea, just like how banning cigarettes during COVID was a terrible idea. Same with banning gambling. But South Africans do have, in general, a pretty bad relationship with alcohol. We have a lot of people who drink alcohol way too much, get into fights, kill each other, you know, use up all their money, et cetera, in this country. You know, there isn't actually a government fix. The fix comes from ordinary people. It comes from society. It comes from, people having different standards and values before parents teaching their kids the right things, people not feeling like, you know, they need to get absolutely blasted every single day, even if they don't have any cash. I think this is a thorny question, and I'm not super keen on government involvement here, because of course these things can very quickly expand in scope to become larger than what is originally suggested. You know, oh, we'll just stop the gambling ads from being outside schools, and before you know it, you know, you're having to go to some sort of underground bunker to play slot machines.
Indeed. Is good. Although, I mean, just thinking about it, I suppose if we were to have, if we were required to choose, probably better to begin to curb the advertising of the thing than the activity itself. But as you say, this, you know, once you set down this road, you have to be very, very careful about what exactly you think you're going to do, what you are, the effect you actually have. Yeah,
exactly.
I mean, if I think of when I started smoking, it was perhaps precisely because it was absolutely verboten and you know, a taboo. And this was one way that I could express my teenage wholly misplaced teenage.
It's exactly why people who belong to like alternative subcultures, you know, do LSD and get all sorts of piercings and stuff, because it's seen as sort of, you know, spicy, sexy.
Independent-minded.
Exactly. Okay. Let's move on to our last story. You know, we usually stick with South Africa. You know, foreign affairs and foreign policies is not really our thing, but this does affect us, and it is kind of interesting as a mirror to what's going on here. In the United States, the Supreme Court has made a ruling which has invalidated many of President Trump's tariffs. President Trump enacted a large number of tariffs. I think every single country in the world, almost every single country in the world, was tariffed. And the powers he invoked to do this was a piece of legislation passed by the U.S. Congress in 1977 called the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, which has the rather funny-sounding acronym of IEEPA. The U.S. Supreme Court, made up of 9 justices, and they voted on basically a decision. And 6 of the 9 voted that using IEEPA to enact tariffs was unconstitutional, that the power to enact tariffs and taxes lies with the U.S. Congress, not with the president's authority. Some of the tariffs remain. For example, I believe steel and aluminium tariffs still exist, and there are some tariffs passed under other pieces of legislation which still stay in effect. Trump also shortly afterwards announced a 10% and then 15% global tariff on every single country to sort of replace the IEEPA tariffs. But the legislation he used for that one, which is Authority Section 122 of the Trade Act of 1974, can only enact tariffs for 6 months. So in order to get his tariffs made into law, he will have to go through the U.S. Congress, which may prove slightly difficult despite the Republican control of it at the moment. Trump was not very pleased with this. He described the decision as a disgrace to our nation, and the justices in the majority opinion as very unpatriotic and, quote, disloyal to the Constitution, but they were also swayed by foreign interests. The court written by the Chief Justice John Roberts of the court, said the president asserts the extraordinary power to unilaterally impose tariffs of unlimited amount, duration, and scope, but the administration points to no statute in which Congress has previously said that language in IEEPA could apply to tariffs. Now, when U.S. Supreme Court justices write an opinion, there's the sort of majority opinion which is taken as the law, but then the justices get the opportunity to write dissents for those who disagree and concurrences for those who agree with the ruling. And the concurrence that's making the most noise is that by Justice Neil Gorsuch, who was appointed by President Trump in 2017, I think. I'm not entirely remembering. He's the first Supreme Court Justice Donald Trump appointed. Neil Gorsuch kind of excoriated all the other justices except the Chief Justice, criticizing them on a variety of grounds on their rulings. He said that those, the more sort of right-wing justices, Samuel Alito, Clarence Thomas and Brett Kavanaugh had applying different rules to Donald Trump than they had to previous presidents. And he said the same thing, by and large, of some of the left-wing justices, Ilana Kagan, Ketanji Brown Jackson, and Sonia Sotomayor. So that has, you know, been quite an interesting thing. He also wrote some pretty interesting comments on this entire process, saying, for those who think this is Justice Neil Gorsuch and his concurrence on the decision, saying, for those who think it is important for the nation to impose more tariffs, I understand that today's decision will be disappointing. All I can offer them is that most major decisions affecting the rights and responsibilities of the American people, including the duty to pay taxes and tariffs, are funneled through the legislative process for a reason. Yes, legislating can be hard and take time, and yes, it can be tempting to bypass Congress when some pressing problem arises, but the deliberative nature of the legislative process was the whole point of its design. Through that process, the nation can tap the combined wisdom of the people's elected representatives, not just that of one faction or man. Their deliberation tempers impulse, and compromise hammers disagreements into workable solutions. And because laws must earn such broad support to survive the legislative processes, they tend to endure, allowing ordinary people to plan their lives in ways they cannot when the rules shift from day to day. In all, the legislative process helps to ensure each of us has a stake in the laws that govern us and in the nation's future. For some today, the weight of those virtues is apparent. For others, it may not seem so obvious. But if history is any guide, the tables will turn, and the day will come when those disappointed by today's result will appreciate the legislative process for the bulwark of liberty that it is. Michael, lot to be said there. Sorry for going on a bit, but it is, I think, quite interesting to watch what is a very strong institution, in this case, the U.S. Supreme Court, and justices, Amy Coney Barrett and Neil Gorsuch, both of whom appointed by Trump, ruling against one of his main policy positions. What's your take on this?
Yes, I think, you know, it has happened before, and I haven't managed to find all the cases, but I'm sure they're very interesting ones. But this is a particularly interesting one where people who are self-evidently eligible for appointment to the Supreme Court are chosen by one or another president, in this case President Trump, they put there, and there is might be it probably is quite a wide popular perception that that this person is, for all intents and purposes, a puppet or a pawn who's going to do the administration's bidding, or the president's bidding is going to be partisan by nature. But in fact, of course, as you say, the institutional nature of the Constitution, Supreme Court of the United States, as is true of other institutions there, it's a huge free society that really does value its freedom. It values its freedom through these institutions, and the participants are absolutely aware of that. We don't always agree with everything that they say. There are sometimes unanimous decisions. There is, there's sometimes rulings that might make the hair in the back of our neck stand on end. But in fact, what we can be sure of, and we should in a way, I mean, I wasn't absolutely confident of Amy Coney Barrett, for example, or Gorsuch, for that matter, beforehand, but I should have been more confident in them. And here we have exactly the illustration of the manifestation of why that is so, that these people's, their standing lies in their courage and independence of mind. That's what they are for, and they understand that that's what they're for. That's why they rose to the position where they became candidates for these posts. And I think it's one of the, you know, remarkably few things in successful societies that really does make them successful is institutions like this, which say the popular will is not always right. It can be called into doubt. A president who has been elected to, you know, enact or follow through, put in place the things that he's promised his public he will do, still has to subject himself and his ideas to public argument. And it's obviously to enormous credit to the Supreme Court itself, that lengthy quote that you read, which I think is terribly important. And if people want to think about what free societies mean and this idea of public argument, I would highly recommend they're going to find Gorsuch's ruling or his argumentation. But he sets it out exactly as we would argue as liberals, that the deliberative nature of the legislative process was the whole point of its design. And this is really, he says, through that process, the nation can tap the combined wisdom of the people's elected representatives, not just that of one faction or man. And that really is, it comes right down to the whole notion of the rule of law, the importance of it, the importance of institutions. And the fact that the court is prepared to argue, make this argument among themselves in public, is a tremendous vote of confidence, I think, for...
That for me is, I think, the most admirable thing about the U.S. Supreme Court is, they lay out their reasoning and they have the footnotes, and by and large, every side of these debates is fairly well argued.
Yes. So
go and read the dissents. Why Clarence Thomas ruled against? Why Samuel Alito ruled against? Why Brett Kavanaugh ruled against? And then, of course, the concurrences were in support of this, which is, were written not just by Gorsuch. I think there were also concurrences by the left-wing justices, and also by Amy Coney Barrett, whose entire concurrence was actually defending herself from Gorsuch's criticism, which is kind of funny. But there is an incredible power in just having that well-reasoned, thoughtful debate put out. It really can clarify issues and get you to the core of things. As to what it means to, as you say, to live in a free society. And, they didn't go over the top here and say, the president has no such power. No, these tariffs are completely illegal. You can never do that. They just said, no, it has to go through the legislative body. We have a process to follow. And these specific powers are not given to this specific branch of government. Yeah. Which is important because, courts can also, of course, get way over their skis and start telling everyone else what to do. This is, I think, a pretty interesting development. As for what it means in South Africa, well, I think firstly, on the broader philosophical point, it's a reminder of the importance of getting your legislature to actually work. Our parliament is not great at debate. It's been getting better, but it's not great. It should be the center of our democracy. It should be where public debate is really heard. And secondly, as for the more mundane stuff about the nuts and bolts, it looks like we've benefited in having some of our tariffs lowered by this decision. There's now probably going to be a lot of legal wrangling that goes on in the US. Some of the new tariffs Trump has imposed, it's unclear as to whether they will stand up in court. They may or may not. That's going to have to be ruled on again. And the most chaotic part of this whole story is that the Supreme Court did not rule specifically on refunds for the tariffs, which is a whole massive can of worms, considering the tariffs have collected around, I think it's over $100 billion. So let's just say that the lawyers are going to be having a great time for business. Because, man, that is a nightmare to get through. And this is one of the points actually raised by Justice Brett Kavanaugh in his dissent, essentially arguing that, look, if you strike down these tariffs, you're going to open a can of worms, which is going to be, I think the word he used was quite literally a mess.
He did, yeah.
Very, very accurate criticism. So I don't know, Michael, any final thoughts before we close up?
I mean, just to really, really endorse everything you've said, and overall, it kind of underscores the vital importance in a free society of institutions that are independent, and institutions like the representative ones, like parliaments and congresses and so on, that they function and that they come to work, with their brains switched on, with some idea that they've actually got to think about what the national interest is, and argue about it and do it in public. And convince people that if one or another thing is something they think needs to be done, well, then they've got to convince the society that this is what's needed, and there's got to be votes, and that's how you go. And if you make the wrong choice, the chances are you confront an independent institution that's going to say you're wrong. You've got to go back to the drawing board and start again. So this is all part and parcel of free societies, which are not, you know, it's not a question of just deciding what the obvious solution is and then doing it. You've actually got to take your society with you. That's what it means to be a free, successful society.
Yeah. Even though it's difficult and even though it takes a long time, which, you know, that is a rule that applies to politics everywhere and at all times, is that the quick and easy road is often not so good at the end of it. Okay, well, with that, let's call this to a close. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you found the show interesting. Please do, if you enjoy the show, like the video. If you're watching on YouTube, do leave us a review on the podcast apps that you may be listening to us to. And we'll see you soon on The Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.
The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR, or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.